Searle. Hi, people.
This is the second of our two lectures about Venus to introduce you to the Pioneer Venus mission, which is the first of the Space 1979 events. Begins actually in December of 1978. That's when the two spacecraft arrive at Venus. Of course, it begins in a sense earlier than that with the launches, but I've been defining the terms here in terms of when spacecraft arrive. For example, the Voyagers were launched last year, but they arrive in 1979, so that's why I'm including them in a lecture series with 1979 in the title. Pioneer Venus, as I mentioned last week, is the first U.S. planetary mission, in fact, the first planetary mission of anybody, in which the primary object of study is the atmosphere of the planet, as opposed to the surface and the interior. Last week we talked about the atmosphere of Venus. This week we'll talk about the surface and interior. There is some study of the geology of Venus, surface and interior, in other words, from Pioneer Venus. Not a whole lot, but 87% of the mission is meteorological, and I suppose that means that 13% is geological. I mean, what else is there in life? So if we could have the lights out, I can start on telling you what is known about the geology of Venus, which for the time being is not really a whole lot, but this will tell you what we do have. Also, in the course of this lecture, I'll tell you what the Soviets have found out from their four landings, Venera 7 through Venera 9. This is a map. I wonder if you could focus that just a little bit. I think the slide's a bit warped, and if you focus it for in here, it's going to be the best. That's great. I mean, it should look fuzzy, and that's that's the point of it. This is a radar map of, as you see, a good part of one hemisphere of Venus. And this is a circle 900 miles in diameter, which is shown in more detail over there on another radar map, which is one of the best, one of the highest resolution that we have. I think that it's almost as remarkable as the fact that we can send spacecraft to Venus, that we are capable of studying its surface by radar from Earth, 25 million miles away, through the clouds, which totally cover Venus, and that we can make maps, such as the ones you see on the left, that show features as small as about 5 miles across with present technology, and that number is still decreasing, and in fact it may decrease to something of the order of a quarter mile very quickly. That would mean radar maps of the surface of Venus through the clouds that are more detailed than the best pictures of the Earth's moon taken through our best telescopes. And that, I claim, is a pretty remarkable thing to be able to do. Unfortunately, the radar maps are a little bit hard to interpret because, first of all, the resolution is still fairly low, and secondly, these are maps that are not what you would get if you photographed the planet. You've got to realize that what's black and what's white here in a picture like this refers not to the reflectivity in terms of how bright the surface is, which, of course, is what you get in a photograph. It refers to the radar reflectivity. And so if you have a region down here, such as this one called Alpha, and one up there called Beta, there's also a Delta. There is a Gamma, it's not shown on this particular map. Those are areas which reflect radar well. They may be black as pitch if you were to look at them, for all we know, but they reflect radar either because they are especially rocky, they are especially rugged, or, ironically enough, they're especially smooth. So either a real flat area or a real rugged area can give you a high radar reflectivity. The chances are that, in fact, these are areas that are especially rocky, and in fact, I'll show you some evidence later on for the contention that Beta is a very large volcanic mountain, and the ruggedness may be due to lava flows on its surface. One of the most remarkable findings, though, came from this very first of these high-resolution radar images. There are now about 15 of them that have been made, and they cover most of the equatorial region of this particular portion of Venus, this particular hemisphere of Venus. This is a hemisphere which is facing towards the Earth every time that Venus is closest to us. And the rotation of Venus is locked in such a way that every time Venus is closest to us, we see the same face, or as we would see the same face in order to the clouds. So, of course, we know that face a good deal better than the others in the radar study. For technical reasons that I'm not going to bore you with, you can do these high-resolution maps, at least with present technology, only in this equatorial belt. And in any one of those maps, there is a bar through the center which you cannot map. So you get these two half-moon kinds of things in each of the 15 sets of data.
Pioneer Venus Orbiter is going to have a radar mapper, in quotes,
which in fact is a pretty lousy mapper.
It will give you
images that are somewhat inferior to these,
but it will do it for most of the surface of the planet. Everything in the orbiter path is over, and the orbiter path is over everything except the extreme polar region.
And although it is a lousy mapper, it is a pretty good altimeter.
And so you can measure the distance from the spacecraft to the surface of Venus with high accuracy, and at least get some sort of two-dimensional profile of each that you're passing over. Is this really a volcanic mountain? Well, you know roughly what the volcano profile ought to be, you know, so you get a pretty good idea of it.
But as I say, one of the most remarkable things that we found came from this very first image. It's a little bit hard to look at because it's blurry and because it has this circular bias, but if you squint your eyes a bit and stare at it, you can begin to see that there are circular features like this one all the way through it, big ones like this and little ones like this, and in fact, those are craters,
very much like those on the Moon or Mars or
Mercury, and the entire area is covered with those craters, and leads
down to the limit of resolution that this radar mapping is possible to show.
Some of them are very large. This one is 160 miles across. This one is 130 miles across. And then there is one, and there is one, and there is one, and there's one, and there's one, and there's one. And as you look at it, you begin to realize that, in fact, the entire thing is covered with craters,
exactly like the high-end areas of the Moon, and in fact, with the same sort of saturation.
Now, this is an astonishing discovery on a planet with an atmosphere as dense as that of Venus's. Not because of the reason you think. It is not because the meteorites that formed those craters should have burned up on the way into the atmosphere.
A lot of people think that this is the reason why the Earth doesn't have very many meteorite craters and the Moon does. Absolutely not.
Something that is so big that when it hits, it's going to form a crater 160 miles across,
is not going to get stopped by the atmosphere of the Earth or even the atmosphere of Venus, even though that is 100 times denser. The small objects do get burned up in those atmospheres, and so we don't have the microscopic craters, which totally cover the surface of the Moon, and almost certainly which totally cover Mercury. Those bodies don't have any atmospheres, and if you go out on any clear night when there's no bright moon, you get far enough away from the light pollution of the city, you'll see these little streaks of light across the sky, things people call shooting stars, and of course they're not stars. They're the smallest meteoroids burning up as they hit the Earth's atmosphere at a speed of, well, at least 7 miles a second. It can be up to 42 miles a second. In case of Venus, it can even be a little bit higher than that. But the big ones don't burn up, and in the case of Venus, meteoroids smaller than about 200 feet across, depends somewhat on what they're made of and how well compacted they are, would burn up in the atmosphere on the way down. But as I say, something big enough to cause a crater like that isn't even going to get slowed down. No, what's remarkable about this finding is that one of the big shocks from Apollo, the exploration of the Moon, and this came right away at the very first landing, as soon as we had the rocks back and we were able to get ages for them, was that the craters had not been forming steadily through geologic time. Almost all of them, 95% to be exact, of the craters that are big enough to be seen from Earth anyway, formed in the first billion years of the Moon's 4.5 billion year history. Apparently there was a tremendous cratering havoc in the first billion years, and by the time it was 3.5 billion years ago, that was almost entirely over. And if you take craters of, say, the 50-mile class, like Tycho and Copernicus on the Moon, exactly two of those, in fact, Tycho and Copernicus, have formed in the last billion years of lunar history. Whereas there were so many in that first billion years that there is, in fact, no place on the Moon that was not hit by at least one, in most cases several, meteorites landing hard enough to form a crater 50 miles across, which incidentally means an explosion equivalent to 2 billion Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. There is no place on the Moon that has not undergone at least one such explosion. Now, if this happened to the Moon, it must have happened to the other planets as well, at least the other inner planets. I don't guarantee the exact numbers are the same. Venus is a little bit closer to the Sun than we are, therefore it's farther from the asteroid belt. If the meteoroids came from the asteroid belt, which we don't know, then it may have taken a little bit longer for Venus to get totally covered by craters. But it must have happened, and it must have happened to the Earth as well. The reason that you don't see the Earth totally covered by craters is that this planet is so geologically active, there are so many erosive products that destroy old processes, that destroy old landforms, and land-building processes which create new ones, that those ancient features have long since been destroyed, And there are, in fact, only a few hundred meteorite craters known on the Earth, most of them in very, very eroded, fossilized form. And you go up on the Canadian Shield, for example, where there are very old rocks in central Canada, and you can find with great difficulty these circular scars in the ground, and those are indeed the roots of old meteorite craters. So what is remarkable about Venus having craters is that here you have a planet with an atmosphere 100 times as dense as the Earth, with a surface temperature hot enough to melt several metals, with a corrosive substance in the atmosphere, the sulfuric acid that forms the cloud, and you would think that there would be a tremendous amount of erosion going on in that planet, whether or not there are compensating processes to build up new landforms. You would think that those craters would have been long since destroyed. And it seems unbelievable that there would have been so little erosion and new construction in this area, that at least in this area. Now remember, this is only one 900-mile section of Venus, a portion about the size of Alaska, except down at the equator. So it's not necessarily going to be true of the whole planet, but at least it's true of this part, that there has been so little erosion and infill that you can still see features which must be something of the order of 3 to 4 billion years old. Oh, there's been a little bit of change. This crater, the big 160-mile one, if that were on the moon, it would be about 3 miles deep. On Venus, it's only a quarter of a mile deep. But there has been only, say, 2 to 3/4 miles of erosion or infill in 3 to 4 billion years since that crater formed. Well, let's think for a moment about the fact that Venus is a similar planet to the Earth, and its atmosphere doesn't seem that way, but as I showed you last time, it really is. The Earth is the one that has a peculiarly modified atmosphere. They both have the same process of creating their atmospheres. Let's consider then the possibility that Venus may be geologically similar to the Earth as well, and ask ourselves what that means. The Earth's crust, the outer part of the planet, which is what you study when you study geology, obviously, with superficial geology, the Earth's crust is divided into two major types of rocks. There is a heavy one and there is a light one. The heavy one, naturally, being heavy, sinks down closer to the center of the planet. And therefore, the places where that rock, which is called basalt, is at the surface, those places are the lowest areas on the Earth, and since we have this peculiar phenomenon of liquid water on this planet, those places that filled in with water, those are, in other words, the ocean basins. So what I'm saying is that 3/4 of the crust of the Earth, the rock that is at the surface, aside from the sedimentary rocks that are formed on top of it, the basement rock that is at the surface is in basalt, and that is what underlies the ocean basin. The remaining quarter of the Earth's crust has a lighter rock, and that is granite, and that is a lighter rock, and so it floats above the basalt, literally floats, in the same way the cake of ivory is so close in the bathtub, and since it is higher up, most of those blocks are able to stick their heads up out of the water a little bit, and those are the continents. The edges of them where they're a little bit underwater, what we call the continental shelf. But that's really the edge of the continent, and if you go off the edge of the continent, first you've got the water getting deeper at a fairly shallow rate, and then all of a sudden you hit this edge and whang, you go down to the abyss. What's happened is you hit the edge of the granite block, the continental shelf, and you suddenly drop about 2 miles down to the basalt floor, which is the ocean basin. On the continents, you have, well, the continents and the ocean basins both, you have the phenomena called plate tectonics. And plate tectonics, if you're not familiar with it, is the modern version of the old idea of continental drift. If you look at a map of the Atlantic Ocean, you will see that Africa and South America could be fitted together if you brought them together and closed up the Atlantic, like portions of a jigsaw puzzle. And North America can be caused to nestle up against Africa, and then there's a corner, and then Europe. And in fact, as soon as the very first map of the New World that were at all reasonably reliable and complete became available, Sir Francis Bacon, way back when, suggested that, in fact, once upon a time, these continents may have been glued together, and then they split apart, and thereby forming the Atlantic. And for a long, long time, geologists did not accept that idea, mainly because they couldn't think of any way that something as big as a continent could move around, plowing its way through that basaltic basement rock, which forms the bottom of the ocean. And in fact, they were absolutely right. Now that we know that, in fact, the continents do move, or at least we're 99.9% certain of it, I mean, you're never absolutely certain of anything in geology, but the plate tectonics is pretty uniformly accepted now. Now that we know this, it is often fashionable to sneer at those old-time geologists and say, look how prejudiced they were. In fact, they were behaving exactly the way scientists should have. They didn't have enough evidence to prove it, and as soon as that evidence came in, right away they changed their mind. And that's exactly the way you're supposed to behave. What happens is, in fact, it's the seafloor, the basalt portions, that are doing the moving, and they are pushing the continental plate along, and those are riding as passive passengers. They are not plowing their way through the basalt. Instead, both the basalt and the passenger continental block are moving over a layer that is further down, that is under the crust, in the very uppermost part of the mantle, which is called the asthenosphere, and which is almost molten, therefore very, very low in strength, and therefore quite slippery. And it lubricates the upper solid blocks, which are called the lithosphere, and those lithospheric blocks move around on it. So, for example, we right now are on a portion of the lithosphere which consists of almost the entire continent of North America plus the entire western half of the Atlantic Ocean basin. And that is moving steadily away from the place where, at the easternmost edge of our plate, the new basaltic material is being generated. It is welling up in molten form from inside the planet and coming out and shoving the whole thing apart, shoving Europe and Africa to one side, shoving us to the other side. The details of how that happens and exactly what does the shoving are still to be worked out, but it seems pretty clear that that's happening. And, of course, if we're getting pushed in one direction, the Earth isn't getting any bigger, so there must be something that is being destroyed somewhere else. And indeed, well, let me oversimplify a little bit, this is truer of South America than North. The Pacific Ocean basaltic plate is being shoved down underneath the advancing American edge of the particular plate that we're on. Okay, that is all called plate tectonics, and is a grossly oversimplified outline of it, but sufficient for our purpose. When these plates move around, the basaltic portions of them are heavy enough that if one plate begins to override another plate, the basalt can simply get shoved down underneath it. And in fact, the basaltic ocean floor plates are destroyed very quickly by this process and constantly being regenerated in the mid-ocean ridges. There is no place on the floor of the ocean that is as much as 300 million years old. And that is not even one-tenth of the history of the Earth. But the continental portions, the big granite blocks, are too light to get shoved down either under another continent or under an ocean plate. And so once they get formed, they remain there. And if the motion of the plate away from the mid-ocean ridges should happen to jam together two continental blocks, they cannot go down, and so they do the only thing that they can do, they go up. They deform at the place where they meet, they shove themselves up into the air, and that is the origin of the great mountain chains of the Earth. It's happening right now as India, which used to be a small continent, has gotten jammed into the Eurasian block, and the Himalayas are still being formed as a result of that. It happened a long time before that when our continent, which at the moment is moving away from Europe, was in fact moving the other direction, and Europe and Africa slammed into it, and that is what produced the mountain chain which arose where the modern Appalachians are. I put it that way because the modern Appalachians aren't a direct result of that. They're a consequence, but that basically is where the Appalachians came from. Okay, what this means is that the mountain chains tend to be at the edge of the continental blocks. And when you find mountain chains that are not at the edge of the continental blocks, for example, the Urals, which run down the middle of the Eurasian block, and in fact are the traditional boundary between Europe and Asia, it turns out when you go into the history that once upon a time those were two separate continents, which got jammed together just the way India and Asia have, and have stuck together ever since. And the time may very well come, sometimes they split apart. That actually did happen with the Americas versus Europe and Africa. They were together, they split apart, they came together again, they split apart again, and they're now still moving apart. Maybe they'll turn around and do it again sometime. Every time, a new chain of mountains got built up, roughly in the same place as the old ones, and always along the edges of the continental blocks for obvious reasons. This is why you find something that might be counterintuitive to begin with, and that is the observation that mountains tend not to be along the middle of the continent. You might think it would be high in the middle and close down uniformly to the edge. Not so. The mountains are along the edges. Okay, what then is in the middle, for example, where we are here in Michigan? Well, basically, what is here is a whole lot of sedimentary rock, which has gotten poured down every time the oceans rose out of their basins a little bit and flooded these shallow interior portions of the continents. And that has been going on back and forth, up and down, ever since, well, ever since we can trace it. But there have been six major episodes of worldwide flooding of continental interiors. So the mountain edges are sticking up out of the water as island chains. Six of these in the last 600 million years. And every one of these laid down a layer of gunk on the bottom, mud and sand and so forth, which then turned into rock as soon as the waters receded and the continents were left high and dry again. Why the oceans periodically come up out of their basins and flood the continents is a very fascinating story too, and I haven't got time to go into it. But, you know, it is, we think that it is known again as a consequence of Plate Tectonics. Fine. With this background to the structure of the Earth, let's summarize. You've got continental blocks with mountain chains at their edges and shallow sea deposited sediments in the middle, and then off the continental blocks and in between them, you have basaltic portions, which are the ocean floors. Consider what this would look like on a world that was just like the Earth, except it didn't have any water. Okay? Well, what would happen is the so-called ocean floors, of course, wouldn't be oceans, but other than that, the rock would be the same. There would not be the sediments on top of them, which you have on our ocean floors as well as on the continents. In fact, you have more sediments in the ocean floors. They're always full of water. But you wouldn't have the basaltic basement rocks. The continents would presumably have the same crumpled up edges. They would be different in detail because there would be no sedimentary rocks even at the edges to get crumpled up, and those are important in our mountain chains, but there still surely would be crumpled edges. But in the middle of the continents, you would not have the sedimentary cover, and you would have large expanses of rock to which nothing had happened since the planet's crust first solidified. Or at least since each of these continental blocks first got joined together in more or less a present form. There's a possibility that you go back billions of years where now the middle of a continent might very well have been a mountain chain, and in fact there was a mountain chain running under Michigan about 2 billion years ago. So it may very well be that our present continents were assembled from earlier continents, but still there ought to be central regions which we think of now as being places where there are sedimentary rocks. We think of them on Earth that way. But if there were no water, then you would find at least some portions of those central regions which had never been disturbed, and therefore which would be chock full of meteorite craters. All right? If, therefore, Venus is like the Earth, up to and including having plate tectonics, you would expect to find some large areas that had lots of craters. You would expect to find some mountain chains, and those should be at the edges of these large crater areas. Those portions should be higher up than the rest, and there should also be extensive regions, more or less flat, of the basalt. Well, at this point, of course, you want me to tell you whether that's what the case is with Venus, and the answer is we just don't know yet. I'm going to tell you as many of the parts of the jigsaw puzzle as we have, and you can draw your own conclusions, but the answer is that we don't know. And one thing that we ought to be able to find out from even the relatively crude mapping of the surface that will be possible by the Pioneer Venus orbiter is that growth structure correct? If you find that indeed you have large blocks that are high with mountain chains at each end and lots of craters in the middle and then the lower areas elsewhere, you would have a pretty good reason to feel that Venus has the same kind of geology as the Earth, including plate tectonics. And that would be one of the most important discoveries ever made in geology of any planet. Because none of the other worlds that we have looked at in space exploration have anything like plate tectonics. Not Mercury, not the Moon, and not Mars. And that is despite the fact that all of those worlds show a crust which is grossly divided into basaltic lowlands and high-lying blocks, which are analogous to the Earth's continents. Although in most cases they are not made of the same stuff. That's another important difference. And so understanding why the Earth is the way it is one of the Mars and Jigsaw puzzle is going to be finding out whether Venus, a planet that is very much like us as far as size and mass are concerned, but does not have water, also has the same kind of structure. Why is it that Earth has poison kinds and these others don't? There are several possibilities, of which the most obvious is the Earth is the biggest of all of those. The Venus is the only one the same size as the Earth. The Moon and Mars and Mercury, which don't have plate tectonics, are all smaller. And it is possible that's the reason, because a smaller body cools off more efficiently than a larger body. Therefore, it doesn't have as much internal heat, it is not as hot on the inside, and therefore there is not as much energy to drive surface phenomena such as plate tectonics. We do not know what it is that makes the plates of the Earth's lithosphere move around, but surely the ultimate energy source is the internal heat of the Earth. And if the Earth didn't have as much internal heat as Mars and Venus and Mercury do not, then maybe that's the reason why those other bodies don't have plate tectonics. Venus, if it is truly like the Earth, should have a similar kind of interior and therefore a similar kind of superficial geology aside from the effects that are due to liquid water. Okay, this is one radar map, and lo and behold, it's full of craters. Let's look at what some of the others show. Here are three radar maps, each of which is the same size, so they're just reproduced at different scales. Each of those, again, is 900 miles across, and these are three which have been put together here to show you processes that will look, to show you features which look as though they were produced by forces inside the planet. You understand there are two major classes of landforms. Exogenic, such as meteorite craters, which are formed by something from outside the planet, and in which the planet's internal energy has no role, and endogenic, things like mountain chains, the batch of basalt plains which form the floor of the Earth's oceans, and so forth, which are formed from inside the planet. Here we have an enormous trough, which appears to have raised edges on either side, and it is something of the order of 800 miles long. It almost covers that 900-mile map. You can see that if you know Mars, everybody's first reaction is, it looks like the Equatorial Canyon on Mars, Valles Marineris. Well, maybe it is. Maybe it has a similar origin, but I doubt it. Because Valles Marineris was produced by wind. We know that now from the Viking orbiter photography and studies that have been made of that. The entire thing was done by wind. It is not a plate tectonics feature. It is not a plate where a continental block is being split apart, as, for example, the combination of the Americas plus Europe plus Africa was 200 million years ago, or as the Arabian block is being split off from the African block right now to form the Red Sea and the East African Rift Valley. That is not the origin of Valles Marineris. It was dug by wind. It started as a relatively small crack in a sort of groove. That's one of the understatements of the century, but basically it's a way to describe it. This is probably not the same sort of origin because, as I will show you a bit later on, there are not strong winds at the surface of Venus. And anyway, if there were, having explained all those craters. So this may very well have a plate tectonics origin. In other words, this may be a Venus equivalent of the Great Rift Valley. Here is a plate where it looks as though there's a mountain arc that has been, in the first place, if it is a mountain arc, that's exciting, but don't get too excited, because even the Moon has mountains. They are the edges of the very largest craters. For example, the Apennine Mountains, which are the highest on the Moon, Apollo 15 landed at their base, are simply the edge of the largest crater on the near side of the Moon, the Imbrium Basin, which is a single crater producing a single meteorite impact that is 820 miles in diameter. So you see how enormous some of these forces were. This may very well be the edge of a meteorite crater, that arc certainly looks circular, or maybe an internal origin, but either way, it looks as though it has been cut into segments. In fact, there's another possibly related segment down there. If so, that may very well be due to a fault. Now, a fault is not just a crack in the ground, it is a crack in the ground along which there has been motion, either side by side, or up and down, or some combination thereof, and that motion has got to be driven by some sort of internal energy. Here is a feature which looks very much as though it is a giant volcano. It looks, at this resolution anyway, as though it is a mountain, and it's got some sort of hole in the center of it, and you don't ordinarily expect a large meteorite crater to manage to target itself so perfectly that it hits exactly on the top of a tall mountain.
You know, that is asking for a certain amount of intelligence in the meteorite that they probably do not possess.
And so when we discover features exactly like this on Mars, through the dust storm in the beginning stages of the Mariner 9 mission, nobody was very bothered by the suggestion that if you've got a tall mountain that has a peak right, a hole right in the center of it, that is probably a volcano with a caldera on top. A caldera is a collapsed crater that is a feature which is formed by either an explosion which blows off the top of the mountain, or a simple depletion of lava in the chamber under the mountain, which gets to the point where so much molten rock has flowed out that the top, there's a hole underground and the top of the mountain can't support its own weight, so it falls down into it. Either way, you call it a caldera. The kind of volcanoes which you see on Mars that have these calderas on top are made of basalt. They are called shield volcanoes because they have a profile rather like a warrior's shield, like so, and then the caldera is at the top in the middle, and they are very, very large. The reason they manage to be so large, for example, Olympus Mons, which is the biggest one that we know on Mars, is a single mountain the size of the state of Arizona, 300 miles across, and it's 15 miles high. Now, the reason it manages to grow so high is the gravity on Mars is not as great as it is, say, on the Earth. On the Earth, a mountain literally could not exist if it was that high. It would crush itself under its own weight. The rock at its base would flow to the side like molasses, and it would scrunch down until it became lower. You get as wide as you want, but not lower. The reason that the mountains on Mars are so wide, however, is probably due to the fact that there is no plate tectonics on Mars. We have basaltic shield volcanoes on Earth as well, but they don't grow that big. And the reason is, we think what causes them is you have a plume, called a mantle plume, of molten material coming up from the upper part of the mantle, and every once in a while the mantle plume becomes active and punches its way to the surface. Molten rock comes up to the surface, piles up and forms a volcano. And then things are quiet. These things are intermittent in activity. They go on for a few million years and then they stop, and maybe 10 million years later they start up again. If the plate has moved during that time, then the next time the mantle plume decides to become active, where it's going to punch its way to the surface, it's not going to be at the same place. And so you're going to have a relatively small volcano here, and then another relatively small volcano here, and another relatively small volcano here, and so forth. And they'll all be basaltic shield volcanoes, but they won't be as big as they grow on Mars. Sound familiar? I'm describing the Hawaiian Islands, which are believed to be exactly that type of feature, formed in exactly the way that I just described. And indeed, when you go to them and you check out the ages of their lavas, they get successively younger toward the eastern end. And that is the end that is supposed to be moving away, moving over the mantle plume, the plate rather, is supposed to be moving from east towards west, so that the easternmost of the volcanoes should be the youngest one, so it all fits. On Mars, you don't have that, so every time the mantle plume comes up to the surface, it pours out its lava at the same place, and these volcanoes can become enormously large. From the most recent Viking orbiter studies of the great volcanoes on Mars, it appears that each one of them took at least, as a conservative estimate, 1 billion years to form, and it may have been longer than that. All right, we have here a volcano which has the profile of a basaltic shield volcano. It has what looks like a caldera in the center, and it is relatively small. The fact that it's relatively small is not itself evidence for plate tectonics on Venus. For one thing, we need another volcano somewhere, and maybe it's just outside the region of the map. But it could just be that that was a relatively gentle mantle plume, or it could be that the origin of that volcano has nothing to do with what I've been telling you about. You know, it's a completely different kind of structure. Let us go on. This is a picture of what that feature may look like if indeed it is what I just told you. This is a painting by John Dixon. Incredibly enough, there are two space artists, both of whom live in California, and both of whose first names are Don and whose last names begin with D. And I mention this because every time I show a slide by Don Dixon, somebody from the audience always pops up and tells me it's Don Davis, and vice versa. This is Don Dixon, and it is a picture of what that volcano might look like, if indeed that's what it is. At a stage towards the end of its formation, you've still got a little bit of fumarolic activity there. And as you heard last week, that's the kind of thing that led to the origin of Venus. There you see the caldera. There's been multiple collapses in this particular caldera, hole within hole. That's one of the ways you can tell a meteorite crater from a caldera. And there you see the shield-shaped profile of the volcano. and that red color in the sky, we'll get to later, is not caused by the same process that causes the red color in the sky on Mars, namely the dust. Here is a radar map showing Olympus Mons on Mars. I mean, this is a Venus radar map, and then there's a photograph of Olympus Mons, the Mariner 9 mosaic, actually, at the same scale. This is the feature called Beta, which I pointed out to you a while ago. It seems to have a depression in the center, it seems to have a roughly shield-shaped profile, and it also seems to be a good 1,000 miles across. If it is, and that's 3 times the size of Olympus Mons, if it is, this is the highest mountain, the biggest mountain, not highest, but the biggest mountain that is known anywhere in the solar system, and even Olympus Mons, although it is higher than this, because remember, a volcano as high as Olympus Mons couldn't grow on Venus. Venus' gravity is practically as great as the Earth. Nevertheless, it's the widest, and of course, if that is a basaltic shield volcano, if it originated the way that I've been telling you about, that could be evidence against plate tectonics on Venus, or it could be that it happened to grow in the middle of one plate that hasn't moved very much recently. We have at least one plate like that, possibly two on the Earth. There is reason to believe that Africa has been stationary for at least the last couple of 100 million years, and Antarctica has been almost as much so. It's rotated a little bit, hasn't moved in. Before that, both of them were indeed moving, but apparently it's possible for a plate to ground itself. So one giant volcano doesn't disprove it, but it's certainly evidence against it. On the other hand, some of those other features that I showed you are evidence for it. And of course, as you're all sitting there thinking, each of these is very inferential, and in no case is it very strong evidence one way or the other. I told you, we don't know the answer. I'm just trying to give you what evidence we have at the moment. Here's another radar map showing a feature which appears to have a raised ring surrounding the depressed interior that is 1,000 miles from one edge to the other that way, and 600 miles from one edge to the other this way. I draw your attention for a moment to this large, very radar reflective area to the east of it. We will see that in a moment. It's called Maxwell, and as you see, it's about the size of Oklahoma. This one is about the size of Hudson Bay. Okay? If this started out as a large meteorite crater, something like the Imbrium Basin on the Moon, only a little bit bigger, you can see that it has gotten very severely distorted in shape. That kind of thing has not happened on the Moon or on Mars, where even the most ancient craters are still perfectly circular. They haven't gotten twisted, they haven't gotten broken, they haven't gotten deformed. And that is part of many pieces of evidence against plate tectonics on those bodies. So if this started out as a meteorite crater, this could very well be evidence for plate tectonics. Of course, on the other hand, you can always argue that in fact it didn't start out as a meteorite crater, it was something else. Maxwell, shown here in a less radar equivalent overexposed picture, is an object that is very irregular in shape, too irregular to make you believe that it could be that it could ever have been a meteorite crater, especially with all this irregular structure in the interior. And since it is so radar reflective and rough, and since it has this irregular shape, the obvious possibility to think of is that it is a large lava flow. That kind of thing could be analogous to the bottom of the Earth ocean, but in that case you'd expect it to extend farther. What I'm really thinking of here is that it might be more analogous to the basaltic lava flows which come out on top of the continents. And they come up, the basaltic lava comes up from the upper mantle, manages to make its way all the way through the thickness of the continental block and spread out on the top of the continental block as something that is small compared to ocean basins but can still be hundreds of thousands of square miles in size. Examples are the Maria of the Moon, beautifully visible tonight. I hope you all saw that magnificent moon rise that we had just at sunset. Proves to you that we really have a full moon tonight at the rise of the sunset. And you look at the man of the moon and you see all these dark splotches. Those are enormous sheets of lava, basaltic lava, covering altogether 2 million square miles of the moon, which came out and covered over the continental rock of the moon in exactly the way that I just described, averaging about 3.5 billion years ago. This has also happened on the Earth in many places, and unlike the Moon at many times in our history, the entire southern third of Idaho and essentially the entire eastern half of Washington and Oregon are one of these huge lava sheets covering 200,000 square miles. It's called the Snake River Plain in Idaho and the Columbia River Plateau farther to the west. As a matter of fact, the eclipse track, the track of the total solar eclipse that I'm going to tell you about next week, goes right over that. And so you might want to remember that. If you're going to see the eclipse, you can see that too. Essentially a lunar mare on the Earth. There is also such a feature in India. There is one in Brazil. In each case, several hundred thousand square miles. And there is the now very badly eroded and almost, in fact, entirely destroyed remnant of one in the Keweenaw Peninsula in our own state of Michigan. That particular one is 1.2 billion years old. So this may be a plateau basalt or a flood basalt, or, of course, it may be something completely unrelated. If it is a plateau basalt, here is another John Dixon painting which shows what it may have looked like when it formed. This is a very accurate kind of picture. These are called fire fountains. Of course, they're not fire. There's a standard human tendency to confuse anything that's hot with fire, and so people assume the sun is made of fire, and it is not. As a matter of fact, it's too hot to burn. You can start a fire and the sun will go out. The sun is hot, and the sun glows because it's hot, not because it's on fire. Same as the, quote, burner, end quote, of an electric stove, which doesn't burn either, quote, because it's hot, all right? And what keeps it hot is the electricity. What keeps the sun hot is thermonuclear reactions. Anyway, these are not fire fountains, but that is the technical term for them. These are places where the molten rock, the molten lava, is coming up from inside the planet, founding up to a height of several hundred feet or even further, and finally falling down there. And here you see places where the lava has congealed and solidified, and the movement of the lava crust, the solidified crust, on top of the still molten lava that is underneath, has resulted in this very characteristic, ropey, contour line kind of shape, which you can see if you go out to the Snake River Plain in the younger parts of it, where it hasn't been messed up by wind deposits, soil being blown on top of it, and that sort of thing. A place called Craters of the Moon National Monument, ironically enough, which shows some flows that are only 2,000 years old. And you will see exactly this kind of structure. It's known by a Hawaiian name. It's called Pahoehoe. There are also places, that means friendly in Hawaii, because it's easy to walk on. There are also places where the crust was a little bit thicker, or the underlying lava was a little bit more viscous, and so it simply got broken up into a horrible, jagged surface of chunks of lava sticking up every which way, and then that solidified, and that is very unfriendly to walk on, and so it is known by the Hawaiian word for unfriendly, which is a'a, that is spelled A-A. It is a word known only to geologists and crossword puzzle freaks. And so that could very well be the explanation for the extreme radar reflectivity of Maxwell. It may be largely ha-ha on its surface. Or, of course, it may be something else. Now, let us show you the Russian spacecraft that have landed on Venus. There have been four of them altogether. This is, for some reason, called Venus 8 here, but generally you don't translate Russian spacecraft names. So you say Sputnik 1, not Satellite 1, and Salyut 6, not Salute 6, and so forth and so on. So generally refer to it as Venera 8, Venera being the Latin word for Venus, and therefore the Russian words. The Russians have got their planetary names direct from the Latin. Venera is the same root that we use in, for example, venerate, because the ancient Romans were very respectful of Venus. Venera 7 was the same way, was one of the earlier Venus landers, which were essentially engineering test vehicles. In other words, it is so terribly difficult to come down through that ferociously hostile atmosphere and come to a successful landing on the surface that the first thing you got to do before you can do any real science is develop the engineering techniques, you know, somehow manage to achieve a landing, somehow get something to work. And so these were relatively simple spacecraft. They still weighed something of the order of 3.5 tons each, but the Russians do these things in a big way. Compare that to somewhat under 1 ton for our Viking landers, and a little bit under a ton for the Pioneer Venus orbiter, a bit over a ton for the multiprobe spacecraft. The landing portion is this landing capsule, number 19 here, number 15 over there, which separates from the main part of the spacecraft. You can see solar panels for power. You can see the very large dish antenna, which was used to communicate with the Earth, scientific instruments up there, and so forth. And this capsule separated down into the Venus atmosphere. The remainder of the spacecraft has been called the FUP, because its function was primarily to deliver the capsule to the planet into the atmosphere too, and burned up, and nobody cared anything about it. But the capsule was protected from descent through the atmosphere, and at the appropriate place, this spherical part opened up, and the lander itself came down to the surface. Venera 7 was man's first successful landing on the surface of another planet. It was in December of 1970, and Venera 8 landed on, landed on July 22nd. That wasn't the year. This is embarrassing, I can't remember. I think it was 2 years later. In any case, the reason that I don't remember is that these were the engineering test vehicles. We got some useful information from them. There were a few scientific instruments, simple ones, put on the landers, but primarily, the scientific information has come from the later two, Venera 9 and Venera 10, which were the real all-out scientific vehicles that could be sent up after the engineering test vehicles that learned how to do it. And if any of you have any doubts that that is in fact the way to do it, you may recall we did the same thing in Apollo. The first few missions were primarily to find out how to land on the moon and get back, and any science that was done was sort of incidental, and they managed to do some of it, and of course the first rocks from any place on the moon were going to be important. But you heard some complaints from the scientific community at the time that it wasn't really science that these were about, and that was just unbelievably stupid in my opinion. If they simply waited, they would have seen that the final Apollo missions were indeed very highly scientific, and we learned a tremendous amount about the moon from them. So most of what we learned about the moon was from the later Apollo missions, same thing with these Venera landings. One thing that we did learn about Venus, though, from Venera 8 was very important. Venera 7 had landed on the night side of Venus, just over the sunset line. And the reason for that was they still had a fond hope that it might be cool on Venera 8 just after sunrise on the day side. Still see having some hope that they might manage to find a cool part if they're going to land a day, at least you land it after sunrise. But in fact, the temperature was about the same. But what they did do was include in the Venera 8 landing capsule not a camera yet, but an instrument to make a landing which was necessary to find out whether there was any point in ever sending a camera to the surface of Venus, and that was a light meter, to find out whether any sunlight managed to get through this this planet-wide blanket of clouds and make it to the surface. And to the amazement of a large number of people, it turned out that yes, indeed, about 2% of the sunlight that hit the cloud top was making it down to the surface. And so, considering that Venus gets more sunlight in the first place, being closer to the sun than the Earth, it's about as bright on the surface of Venus in the daytime as it is on Earth on a reasonably thick, overcast day in the middle latitudes of the Earth, say where we are, the kind of normal weather that we have in Michigan, you know, in the winter. And today, of course, was a peculiar exception. Any of the kids, I hope you weren't worried that that brilliant yellow light you were seeing is called the sun. It is perfectly normal. It's all right. You know, it's just that we don't generally observe it from Michigan. In a typical Michigan day, it's about as bright as it is in a typical day on Venus. Of course, it's a little cooler. But other than that, it is similar. And so the Venera 9 and 10 landers did indeed have cameras on them. Here is a picture of either Venera 9 or 10. They were practically identical. They are enormous objects. This portion, which is not just a bus now, that has a lot of instruments of its own, and that went into orbit around Venus, becoming the first spacecraft ever to do so. That portion, the orbiter, weighed almost 4 tons by itself, and the landing capsule weighed almost 2 tons. So this is 5.5 tons worth of equipment, which was launched by the Russians towards Venus twice, and I can remember very easily just 20 years ago, last October 4th, the launch of Sputnik 1, and it was basically the same rocket, believe it or not, in which Americans just could not believe that it was so tremendously heavy. It was 184 pounds. I remember a press story to the effect that we figured it out. It was a misprint. It should have been 18.4. It was, in fact, 184, and the next year they launched a half ton Sputnik 3, but by then I think Americans were immune to amazement about the Russian space program. Well, these are 5.5 tons each,
What you've got is the lander here still inside its descent capsule, and then the orbiter, which separates from the lander 2 days out from the planet, and then changes its direction. It was heading directly towards the planet, and it separates from the lander, and the lander is still heading directly towards the planet, and then the orbiter veers off, fires its rocket engines enough to change its trajectory so it won't hit the planet, and goes into a highly elliptical orbit around it. The lander, meanwhile, goes down and strikes the atmosphere of the planet. This is a cutaway view inside that aeroshell, heat insulating shell is what they call it here. Aeroshell would be Viking or Pioneer Venus terminology. In other words, the heat shield, the thing that prevents you from getting burned up. Not now yet by the heat from the surface. Don't get your two heat sources confused here. We're talking about the heat of the 17,000 mile an hour entry into the Venus atmosphere, which is going to heat that aeroshell to a temperature of several thousand degrees. So it is made of an ablative material, a material which will evaporate as a result of that heat and vaporize off and go flying off as a long trail of, I almost said fire, of course it isn't really, and thereby sacrifice itself to save what is inside. The lander is what is inside. When it is safe, the aeroshell splits off, first one half and then the other, and parachutes begin to come out one after another of this parachute compartment. Those parachutes are quite remarkable. The largest set of them, a set of three, has a total surface area of something like 500 square feet. But, that, I'm sorry, 1,500 square feet, 500 square feet each. And those are fine for the intermediate part of the entry into Venus's atmosphere. You know, the first part you do is with the aeroshell. The intermediate part, where you're floating down through the cloud layers, which are still high above the planet, you do on the parachute. But then you begin to get into atmosphere that is so dense that those parachutes have suddenly become a liability instead of an asset. And in fact, the Russians found that out the hard way. That was how they lost their first four attempts to land on Venus that got into the planet's atmosphere, only to be destroyed by the deep depression of sulfuric acid on the way down. You don't let go of that parachute, and you stay so long floating down that the heat and the pressure and the sulfuric acid get to you. And so on these landers, at a height of 30 miles above the surface, the parachutes were deliberately cut loose. The lander then, of course, began to fall towards the surface, and it picked up speed until it reached a speed of several hundred miles an hour. But further and further down into the atmosphere it got, more and more the atmosphere floated down, and there is a device here under the antenna, which is a typical example of a beautifully simple Russian solution to a technological problem that we might have done in a very much more complicated way. It's labeled here, you notice, not just antenna reflector, which is what it is, but aerodynamic shield. That little device, shaped like the brim of a hat, stood in lieu of the parachute for the final 30 miles of descent. It floated down using the air resistance against that shield until it touched the surface at a speed of only 15 miles an hour. And then that 15 miles an hour was taken up by this crushable donut-shaped landing device, as it's called, which, number one, crushed, and there were also shock absorbers on these flexible legs to take up that 15-mile-an-hour impact, and number two, guaranteed that if you didn't land on the edge of a cliff or something, the spacecraft would be held more or less upright. Now you have the problem of the other heat that you encounter on this mission, the tremendous 900-degree Fahrenheit surface temperature of Venus, and if you'll take a look at the thickness of this insulation, you will get some notion of why the lander weighs as much as it does. They had a ferocious air conditioner inside that thing, too, blasting away. And in fact, these measures were very successful. The Russians insist that it was not the heat or the pressure that cut off the transmissions from either Venera 9 or 10. Both of them landed on the side of Venus away from the Earth. Both of them on the day side, and of course the day side is more or less towards the sun. So if you're going to land on the side away from the Earth, if you want to be on the, if you're going to land on the day side, you're going to be on the side away from the Earth. In general, if you play it right, you can manage to have a thin crescent of day side still visible from the Earth. And we are going to do in fact exactly that on Pioneer Venus, where the communication will be directly to the Earth and from all of the probes from the bus itself. There won't be any relay to the orbiter, so you've got to be in line of sight of the Earth. But on these Venera landers, the latter two, the first two, of course, had to communicate directly with the Earth, so they went on the side towards it. But in the latter two, they landed on the far side of Venus and seen from Earth. All of their communications were through the orbiter, which was used as a communication satellite, the same way as we did with the Viking landers on Mars. And the Russians insist that when their communications cut off, which was after about 1 hour and 5 minutes in the case of Venera 10, and 1 hour and 9 minutes, that's the all-time record so far, in the case of Venera 9, the reason was not because they were destroyed. The temperature inside at that time was still well below the boiling point of water, in fact, it was about 150 degrees Fahrenheit. The reason the communications cut off was the orbiters set. They passed below the horizon of Venus, as seen from the respective landing site. Of course, by the time they rose again, something like 2 days later, the landers had had it, so you weren't going to have any more communication. But it's interesting to speculate on just how long they would, in fact, have been able to last. A lot of scientific equipment in there. There is the camera, which is labeled telephotometer here. There is also an anemometer up there on the top to measure how strong the winds were, turned out to be very gentle at the surface. There were temperature and pressure measuring devices, and there were some other gadgets, which I'll tell you about a little bit later on as we get to its results. This is the entry sequence into the atmosphere. 2 days out, here's the orbiter with the lander attached. 2 days out, the lander separated, and the orbiter then went off and went into orbit itself, as I told you. And then a sequence of parachutes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them all together come out one after another, slow the spacecraft, bit by bit until the parachute has lost its effectiveness. One after another, it's jettisoned. This is the portion where you are slowly drifting down through what turned out to be the cloud layer. They made an excellent guess as to what the height of the use of these parachutes ought to be. They drifted down slowly through the cloud layer, and so they were able to study that in detail, and right at the bottom of the cloud layer turned out to be the place where they jettisoned the three main parachutes. They were, in fact, on the parachutes from a height of 40 miles up to a height of 30 miles up, and doggone if the cloud layers don't turn out to extend from 39 miles to 30 miles. So the gods were with them on that. But it's just, they didn't know ahead of time. They couldn't have. It was these observations they made on the way in that we found out where the cloud layers are, but they were just very lucky. And then the spacecraft drifts down the aerodynamic shield, takes about 20 minutes to go from the place where they jettisoned the parachute 30 miles up to that gentle 15-mile-an-hour landing, and finally you come to a more or less direct position on the surface at the landing. Immediately, the first thing they did was jettison the dust cover of the camera. That was the second thing they did. The first thing that they did was reach out a hammer-like device, which was to measure the density of the rock where they landed, and slam it into the surface with about the force of a sledgehammer hitting. Then the dust cover of the camera was removed. You see the obvious reason for that sequence. And 2 minutes after the landing, the camera began to take a picture. I'll tell you about the picture in a moment. Here is a Soviet artist's concept of the lander on the surface of Venus. The clouds have been cut away to show the orbiter up there. Of course, it's looking a little bit too big in this picture. And you can see the camera. The dust cover, in fact, is not drawn correctly there. It should be a vertical slit. And the reason for that I'll show you in a moment. And the densitometer, I guess the densitometer is not in this picture, but you'll see it in the real photograph, actually from the surface of Venus. So let us show you those now with, not quite yet. All right, I said with no further ado, there isn't further ado. I've got to give you the entry science data. This, I suppose, logically might have gone into last week's lecture because this is about the atmosphere, but it's this week that I tell you about the Venera landing mission. So here they go. These are profiles of the temperature and the pressure in the Venus atmosphere as a function of height above the surface. And 50 kilometers is just about 30 miles, and so the cloud layer starts about there and goes on up a little bit out of the picture. For this temperature profile, that's all these lines here, you notice we got every single one of them from Venera 4, which was the very first of those attempts, and follow the dotted line down, and you see it was destroyed 25 kilometers above the surface, all the way down to the most recent of the landers, Venera 10. and you can see the profile is more or less the same, and it's a little bit hotter on one side than the other, and the reason for that is these are the day side landings, and all these down here are the night side landings. There is a difference in the temperature in the upper atmosphere, and as you go down farther and farther into the atmosphere, and you get more and more of it, the two curves converge until it's essentially the same at the surface. The reason that the surface measurements do not agree exactly is that apparently the two vendors landed at places that were slightly different heights. One of them was 1.2 miles higher than the other. Incidentally, if you'd like to know where they landed on Venus, one of them was at latitude 15 degrees north, the other was at latitude 31 degrees north, and Vendor 9 was the one that was farther north, and it was almost, but not exactly, due north. Did I say Vendor 9 was farther north? Vendor 10 was farther north. Vendor 10 was almost due north, not exactly, of Vendor 9. And if you went two places on the surface of the Earth, which have the same latitudes and the same slight difference in longitudes, so that you can imagine the two landers coming down those places on the Earth and thereby picture what they did on Venus, Guatemala City for Vendor 9 and Central Mississippi for Vendor 10 will do it for you. Okay? So essentially that's what these two landing sites were. Okay, the temperature scale is like this. This is in Kelvin. They use here the old nomenclature, degrees Kelvin. You're not supposed to do that anymore, Kelvin. And a temperature of 273 Kelvins, which would be just over about there, so it's just outside the chart, it would be a line like this, is the freezing point of water. A temperature of 373 Kelvins, which would be down through here, is the boiling point of water. And so we can see that at the base of the clouds, about 50 kilometers up, the temperature, that's just about where the temperature reaches the boiling point of water. Under that, the temperature gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter until finally, at the surface, it is around 700 Kelvins, which is around 900 degrees Fahrenheit. You'll notice the temperature increases almost in a straight line fashion as you go down. There is a reason for that. Those of you who know what the word troposphere means will understand that that's the reason, and those of you that don't, it's just, you know, I can't tell you everything in 2.5 lectures, no matter how much I say. This was indeed to be expected. The shock was that when you got down to the surface, the temperature was as great as it was. This is the pressure curve. You can see the data for all the spacecraft are virtually identical, and that shows how static the atmosphere tends to be. You'll notice that the pressure mounts up tremendously as you get towards the surface. I was talking to a gentleman tonight who was saying, gee, I just ran across an interesting fact about the Earth's atmosphere. Half of it is within 3 miles of the surface. In other words, you climb up on the top of it, just a 3 mile mountain. There are plenty of mountains like that on the Earth. And lo and behold, you are above half of the Earth's atmosphere. Well, that is the way atmospheres behave. They are compressed by their own weight, and so they're very, very severely squashed toward the bottom. And in fact, if you go from the surface of the Earth to 3 miles up, that's half of the Earth's atmosphere. Go another 3 miles up, and the pressure is again cut in half, so now it's only 1/4 of what it was on the surface. Go another 3 miles up, and it's again cut in half, so it's 1/8 of what it was on the surface, and so on and so forth. And that height is roughly what is called the scale height of the atmosphere. Actually, the scale height is the height above which it goes not to 1/2, but to 1/2.78 of the value of the surface. That's just to make sure that you're confused and don't understand what's going on. But basically, that's called the scale height of the atmosphere. The scale height itself changes somewhat as you go through the atmosphere because the structure of the atmosphere changes. But basically, the scale height of Venus's atmosphere, well, let's look at it. Here's pressure in kilograms per square centimeter, and a kilogram per square centimeter is almost exactly equal to the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth. So just assume that this bottom chart there, this bottom scale says pressure in Earth's atmosphere. It is 90 Earth atmospheres at the surface. Let's see where it goes down to 45. That would be right here, and that is about 11 kilometers up, and 11 kilometers would be of the order of, something like 7 miles. So we've got a scale height on Venus about twice as great as the scale height on Earth. And the reason for that is that it is a hotter atmosphere, the pressure keeps it, the temperature keeps it expanded, and also, to some extent, there is a little less gravity, and also, to some extent, it's because it's made of a different substance. It's mostly carbon dioxide, our atmosphere is mostly nitrogen. And again, the shape of this curve is exactly what you expect. It's called an exponential curve. That is the curve that you get through something that's squashed under its own weight. Now, let's take 10 Earth atmospheres. We see that that is a height of about 30 kilometers, or about 20 miles. Let's take one Earth atmosphere, that is going to be just about at the height of the bottom of the cloud layer. So when you're at the bottom of the clouds on Venus, you've just run out of sulfuric acid, and it's not a well-defined bottom. It turned out from the better observations on the way in, the clouds are very diffuse. They have a very diffuse bottom edge and almost diffuse the top edge, and the number of cloud particles gets greater and greater to about the middle, and then peters out and becomes less and less. But at the bottom of the clouds, it's just about the temperature of the boiling point of water, and the pressure is just about the same as it is at the surface of the Earth. And it's full of horrible sulfurous fumes. In other words, it is very much like Gary, Indiana in summer. The cloud measurements that were made on the way down, there were a number of devices that were used, and we'll have the same sort of gadget for the Pioneer Venus plus a bunch of other things. One of the gadgets is called a nephelometer, and what it is a radar only uses light, or actually infrared. You have a little device, I'm sorry to disappoint the technical freaks in the audience, but it's not a laser, either on the Venus or on Pioneer Venus. Just a little light, which shoots out some light, and if you're inside a fog, some of your light's going to come back to you, right? And so it measures the intensity of the light that comes back. And by using that very simple means, you can figure out how dense the clouds are at any given height. Pioneer Venus is also going to have, on its large probe, a cloud particle size sensor. It's going to measure the size of the particles, but as I told you about last week, we expect those all to be within a very narrow range, and they should all be within very close shouting distance of 1/50,000th of an inch in diameter. And if they're not, somebody's going to have some explaining to do. Well, the surprising thing about the clouds, as measured by the nephelometer on the descending capsules in Vedder 9 and 10, was that they're not really dense, thick clouds the way the term cloud usually makes you think of on the Earth. You know, you get into a cloud in an airplane and you just can't see anything. But this is really more like a thin haze or a smog. And if you were in it, you could see anywhere from, a mile to 3 miles or more, depending on where you were. Even in the densest part of it, you'd be able to see a mile or more. In fact, most of the cloud layer of Venus has visibility that is good enough for visual flight rules if you're flying a light plane, assuming that you were doing it on the Earth and the clouds weren't made of sulfuric acid and little details like that. So really, the so-called cloud of Venus, that's a misnomer. It's really more like a thin haze. Now, when I say thin, I mean that it isn't dense. It is 9 miles from the top to the bottom, so it's thick in the other sense of the word thick, and that is why you are not able to see the surface of the planet through it. But you are able to see the sun through it from the surface. And if there were something down there on the surface that were as bright as the sun, you'd probably be able to see that from orbit. The problem is there isn't. All those craters and mountains and so forth are not lighted up that well, and so you're not able to see through the clouds from orbit. But therefore, you get an idea that they are very, very much thicker than in fact they're very much denser than in fact they actually are. And this is the reason why Venera 8 was able to make that measurement, showing a significant amount of light getting through the clouds to the bottom of the clouds, to the surface. Underneath the bottom of the clouds, it was absolutely crystal clear all the way down to the surface. Some people have suggested there might have been a dust layer in the atmosphere stirred up by the winds from the surface. It simply didn't happen. And the reason for that became obvious when measuring wind. There's wind out here at the surface. Here is a chart in which I have mercifully converted all of the values into English units that you're familiar with. Cloud layer, I drew a little bit wrong, should extend down to 30 miles, extend up to 39. And this is the wind speed as measured on the way down by Venera 8, Venera 9, and Venera 10. And in fact, I got to redo this graph sometime because it gives you a false impression. You'll notice that both Venera 9 and 10 encountered winds in the cloud layer and down to a height of about 20 miles and were just about the same all the way down, and those winds were about 150 miles an hour. And then the winds fell off very, very sharply until you reached, as far as you can tell, the scale of this graph, zero at the surface. In fact, what they measured at the surface was a breeze. The greatest that it measured, it varied a little bit, it was a fitful breeze, and the greatest that either of them measured was a mile and a half an hour. Now that's not negligible in an atmosphere that dense. You've got to remember that in many respects, you must think of this atmosphere at the surface anyway as a liquid, rather than the sort of thin gas that you're used to here on the Earth. So a better analogy for what it's going to be like if something moving that much air at a mile and a half an hour hits you is if you imagine going down and landing on the bottom of the ocean on the Earth, okay? It is not negligible. In fact, the way it goes is the amount of pressure produced by a given wind in the atmosphere of a particular planet goes as a square root of the density of that atmosphere. And so plug in the numbers. If it's 100 times as dense, square root of 100 is a 10. And what that means is that a mile and a half an hour breeze on Venus is equivalent to a 15 mile an hour wind at the surface of the Earth as far as the amount of pressure is concerned. And that's what determines whether you get blown over and whether your flag will fly and so forth and so on. So 15 miles an hour is hardly destructive, but it is a certain amount. And it becomes still just a little bit more mysterious why there has been so little erosion and why we can still see those 3 or 4 billion-year-old craters. Venera 8 actually ran into a more typical thing. If you could have continued these curves higher, the measurements had started higher, Venera 9 and 10 probably would have run into high winds up there too. But somewhere in the cloud layer, generally down towards the bottom of it, more than up towards the top, most of those entry spacecraft, I'm telling you this, not from something that you can see from this graph, but from what I know of the observations of Venera 4, 5, 6, and 7 as well, most of them hit very, very high winds down in the cloud layer, winds that went up to 300, even 400 miles an hour. And those are the winds which are responsible for what you saw last week, that very, very rapid motion of features in the cloud layer. That is what is responsible for that 4-day motion of cloud features around the planet. These enormous winds that you have in the upper atmospheric layers. And bear in mind, that's not negligible, even by Earth standards, the amount of air up there at the bottom of the cloud layer, where you're still having winds on this Venera 8 chart of 150 miles an hour, twice hurricane velocity, the density of the air is already as great as it is here at the surface of the Earth. So that was a true hurricane that those spacecraft came down through, still on their parachutes at that level, and it was even that much more of a remarkable feat that the Russians were able to pull this off. All right, here are the historic first pictures ever taken on the surface of Venus or any other planet other than the Earth and Moon. These are the original raw versions as they first came out, and I have much better ones that I'll show you in a moment, but I want to show you features you can see even on these as well. The way the camera took the picture was this. You know, you got these telephone pole things looks like snow on your TV set. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what it is. That's electronic interference, random static. The way the camera took the pictures was this. These are not television cameras. These are the same kinds of cameras that were used on the Viking landers. That is to say, they are facsimile scanners. You have a stationary light detector, which is looking up through a lens at a mirror, which nods up and down. And the mirror nods slowly and scans a vertical line across the landscape, and then the whole thing moves over a little bit, and the mirror nods back and scans another vertical line. Whole thing moves over and scans another vertical line, and so forth. That doesn't give you terribly good resolution. That is to say, fineness of detail that you can see. Even the Viking landers, which had a better camera than these Veneras did, took pictures in which the very best resolution you had right at the foot of the spacecraft was only about the size of an aspirin tablet. And on these pictures, even there at the foot of the spacecraft, this is that crushable landing device. Remember that donut-shaped thing down at the bottom? And there it is on Venera 10 as well. This one's Venera 9, this one's Venera 10. Even right there next to that, you can't see anything smaller than about an inch across. So these are not terribly good pictures in that sense, but they are good in another sense. They can show quite a large portion of the landscape, and they can show with geometric accuracy, and they can also measure brightnesses very much more accurately than a TV system could. So you lose some things, you gain others. The reason for using a facsimile camera here instead of a TV camera was partly that it's a simpler system. The Russians always go for simple things when they can. They sent these facsimile cameras into the moon. First picture ever taken on the surface of the moon by Luna 9 was sent back by a camera exactly like this. And the other reason in the case of Venus is you cannot build a television camera that can survive extreme heat. You can do it with a facsimile camera. So, what would happen is, strip by strip, the camera would slowly paint the picture, and as it painted, it sent back the data to the Earth, and then, all of a sudden, it would interrupt the picture transmission to send back the other data, engineering data about the spacecraft, temperature, pressure, wind speed, all the other things, and every time it interrupted, the camera still kept scanning, and so you got one of these vertical telephone poles of static. And then the camera would come back on again, get some more pictures, more telephone poles, and so on.
until the camera has scanned entirely 180 degrees. You must realize that these pictures that I'm showing you are not to scale. I can't show them to you to scale. If I could, they would have to wrap halfway around you. Okay? So the picture is 180 degrees from one edge to the other. From the top to the bottom, it is 40 degrees. In other words, you start out, the center of the picture is, if this is a spacecraft equator, like so, in other words, what would be horizontal if it landed perfectly upright, you start at the center of the picture is the point that is 45 degrees under that spacecraft antenna, equator, like this, all right? So what you're doing is starting out looking at the horizon, a little tiny bit of horizon there, you see it better in the improved version of the picture, and then you're scanning down, like so, looking down at a 45 degree angle in front of you, and then back up again until you see a little bit of horizon and a view of the clouds of Venus from the inside at the upper right-hand corner of each of the two pictures, okay? And the height of each of these pictures is 40 degrees. In other words, centered on 45 degrees in front of you, 20 degrees above that, and 20 degrees below that. That's what you're seeing there in the middle of the picture. Now, there is the densitometer, which has slammed itself into that rock and made a measurement of how dense the rock is, how heavy the rock is. The arrow is pointing to a feature which turned out not to be terribly important, in fact, the crack in the rock, but this is the... I'm sorry, that's not the densitometer at all. This is the densitometer, and the arrow is pointing to the densitometer with a possible crack in the rock, which may have been caused by the densitometer and may not. It's hard to tell. This is the densitometer on Venera 9, and this is that dust cover of the camera on Venera 10, which happened to show up in the picture in that way, not the other one. Now, even in this picture, I think you can begin to see that there is a difference in the overall appearance of the scene in Venera 9 and Venera 10. It looks blobbier down here somehow. And you can see the most startling discovery that was made in these pictures, and that is not only is there enough light so that you can see the scene in the first place. The Wright themselves, they did have lights on these spacecraft if they needed them, but they never needed to turn them on, so they didn't. That is natural sunlight, you can tell that. You can tell that because not only is there light, all of the rocks are casting shadows. And from the direction of the shadows, you can tell the light is in fact natural sunlight, so it comes in the same direction. Bear in mind, you're looking in a 180 degree different direction over there than you are over there. So not only is there sunlight getting through the clouds of Venus, but the sun appears as a recognizable separate light source up there in the clouds. It's not just a uniform illumination all over the sky as you have on an overcast day on Earth. That is a really incredible finding. But apparently it is so. I mean, otherwise, that explains the shadows. Here is a rectified version of the two pictures, again, Venera 9 on the top and Venera 10 on the bottom, with some of the telephone poles removed. What happened was that after the camera got over to the right-hand edge of the picture, it then began scanning back, sending another version of the same picture. And of course, most of the interruptions the second time around weren't the same vertical line as they were the first time around. And then when it got back to the left end, it began scanning back again, and in each case it got about to the middle, a bit short of the middle, at which point the transmission cut off. So we've got three complete scans of this section of the picture and two complete scans of the rest. And I believe for this rectified version, not all of that information was used, but we've gotten into some telephone poles anyway. This is a rectified version, which means the computer has replotted all the dots that make up the picture so that it looks the way it would if you were actually standing there on Venus and you were looking through some sort of crescent-shaped map which delimits the borders of the picture. And so you can see the horizon is indeed more or less flat as it ought to be, and the horizon of the Venera 10 picture is flat as well. And now you begin to see that there are differences in the pictures. For example, that horizon over there looks fuzzy, and it looks as though there's a region where there in the landscape you are looking through a considerable amount of air which is scattering the light from that distant scene. In other words, the horizon in the Venera 10 picture must be several miles away. In the Venera 9 picture, however, the horizon appears sharp, and you have apparently silhouetted boulders up there on it. furthermore, as you look at the rocks, you suddenly realize the reason for all this. You are perched on the side of a hill, and you are looking uphill in this direction, and that is a near horizon, something at most a few tens of feet away from you, which is the edge of some little portion of the hill, some little local ridge on the hill, above which those rocks must be coming from. And then as you look in the other direction, remember this is the opposite direction from this, you are looking down the hill and you're seeing rocks on the way down this slope. On this picture, you don't see very many individual rocks. What it looks like is a whole lot of individual portions of relatively flat material and some sort of dark stuff in between, as though what you've got is a flat bedrock surface with soil thinly scattered here and there upon it, and places where the bedrock is actually showing through, bedrock outcrops. And that will be very much clearer when we go to the final version of the picture, which is not rectified, unfortunately, but which has been very thoroughly computer processed so that you can actually begin to see what is going on. And so these are the ones that I really want to talk about. Now you get a very good view of each of those densitometers. You can see that in both cases, the densitometer sensor, which of course you can't see because it's driven down into the Earth, into the rock, has in fact gone down into solid rock. You get a good view of the camera dust cover there and so forth. And right away, you see evidence for semi-intelligent life on Venus. There's a half-eaten McDonald's hamburger. In fact, that's a very interesting rock because it is one of several rocks in the picture that appear to be layered. And layering, notice the flat character of many of them as well. And that goes along with the idea they're layered. And this looks very much as though we've got edges of layers, and that looks like it, and it looks as though there's a suggestion of layering there. And layering means sedimentary rocks. Oh, it could mean lava flows, but not that thin and not that even a layer. Typical lava flow layering is something you see in the side of a cliff of lava that's a quarter of a mile high or something, and the layers are tens or hundreds of feet thick. And so it may be that there are processes which are somehow able to create sedimentary rocks on Venus, in other words, cement together soil particles in the absence of liquid water. We do not know what those processes might be, but considering the kind of temperature that must go on at that heat and that pressure and that weird atmosphere, you can believe almost anything. In fact, there is reason to believe that this stuff, which I tried to convince you a few moments ago is bedrock, is actually some sort of crust, thin cemented together substance on the surface. You'll notice that these pieces are jagged, as though they are relatively recent in origin. Because, you know, weathering of any sort, whether it's physical or chemical, anything that will attack a rock and either break it down physically or break it down chemically, attacks corners first, edges second, and centers third. And the reason for that is just very simple geometry. A corner is a place where there are three faces, all sides of which can be attacked. An edge is a place where there are two sides that can be attacked. A face is a place where there's only one direction you can attack from. Okay? And so any sort of weathering, no matter what the agent may be, acts in the direction of rounding off rocks. So when you see jagged fragments of rocks like this, you can tell that they have been formed in the sense that they've been broken up that way relatively recently. You're on a hillside which is full of jagged chunks of rock, and that is what on Earth would be called a talus slope, T-A-L-U-S, or C-U sometimes called a scree. A talus slope is a place where rock has been broken off up on the mountain somewhere, and slowly the pieces are making their way downhill under the action of gravity. Okay, all that sounds very simple if you don't know very much geology. The problem is, you got to ask what it is that does the breaking up in the first place and why the rocks are able to move downhill very slowly, of course. This is over geologic time scales, unless you are unlucky enough to hit a talus slope in which you're almost at the angle of repose, and then on human time scales you end up at the bottom, hopefully alive. It could be very dangerous. It is very dangerous in mountain climbing skiing. The agent that on Earth usually does the breaking up is the seasonal expansion and contraction of water. As it expands in the winter when it freezes and contracts in the spring and summer when it thaws. It gets down into the cracks. There are always cracks in bedrock for one reason or another. The cooling cracks in lava, places where the rock is a little bit less weak and anything has attacked it. If nothing else, tidal forces. And there are tidal forces on Venus, not from a moon, but from the sun. Venus is enough closer to the sun than we are. The tidal force of the sun is quite significant. So the water gets down into the cracks on Earth rocks and expands and contracts and expands and contracts and pretty soon knocks off pieces of rock. They then make their way downhill, again as a result of the fact that there's water on the Earth, and the water, well, if they're small pebbles, actually washes them down. If they're larger chunks of rock, it undermines them until they begin to fall a little bit. And that is what is necessary to get rock down a slope that is not steep enough that it would fall under its own weight, as most slopes on Earth are not, and in fact, as this slope on Venus is not. It's a fairly steep slope, but it's only about 15 or 20 degrees, and that is not enough for the rocks to fall down under their own weight. So the question is, how can you have a talus slope on Venus? Tell us the answer to that. Well, we don't know. There is no water. My feet are filled. There is no water. And we can't really think of anything else that would have the same kind of effect. This expansion and contraction bit is something that is unique to a substance, which is in one phase, in this case solid, at one time of the year, and another phase, in this case liquid, at a different time of the year. And we just can't think of anything that would be that way on Venus. But nevertheless, there they appear to be. Now, of course, there's another possibility, and that is you may have yourself a slope of there. In other words, you may be on the side of a volcanic hill of some sort. And again, though, the question is, why do those look so fresh, and why does it give you the general appearance of a talus slope? And if this is basalt or some sort of volcanic material, how do you explain this relatively fine-scale layering? In the lower picture, I started to tell you evidence that this so-called bedrock is actually a crust. Well, in the first place, you see some very suggestive-looking cracks. In the second place, you notice that all of the edges, all the corners, seem to be more or less rounded, except one. There is the only place where there's a more or less jagged set of contours, as though a piece had just been knocked out. And when you look around the corner, there is a piece. That fits into this hole like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. May not be obvious in this particular picture, but one of the things they did was use the computer to make a map of how this scene would look as seen from directly above. And when you do that, you can see these are exactly the same size and shape. So it looks as though something has gouged out a little piece of crust there and moved it around like so. What kind of rock are we dealing with? Well, first that I have to explain to you is that the contrast in both of these scenes has been very much artificially exaggerated. As though you turn you had a scene in your television set and you turn the contrast knob all the way up. So there's actually very little contrast in this scene. The soil is not nearly as much darker than the rock as it appears. In fact, both the soil and the rocks are exceedingly black material. Blacker than any common rock on Earth. Blacker, in fact, than most basalts on Earth. And immediately, some of you who have heard me lecture before are thinking carbonaceous chondritic material. No way. We know that Venus is differentiated. There is probably some chemical process which is attacking the surfaces of these rocks and blackening them, something analogous to desert varnish perhaps on Earth. Not closely analogous because that requires liquid water, but some sort of chemical alteration on the surface. And indeed, that is an explanation that was given for the red color of the Martian rocks and soil as well. So what kind of rocks are they? Well, we have two pieces of evidence on this. The densitometer readings on both Venera 9 and 10 gave rock of the same density as our old friend basalt. Both of the landing sites seemed to be relatively low compared to the average Venus surface, and so that would fit. And there were measurements made on not only Venera 9 and 10, but also Venera 8 of the radioactivity of the surface rocks. Now, any rock is slightly radioactive, not enough to do you any harm, of course. But just as any rock has small amounts of gold in it or platinum or anything else you might be interested in as an impurity, so any rock has very small amounts of uranium, thorium, and potassium-40, all of which are radioactive. And different kinds of rocks have different amounts of them. Granite, for example, has a good deal more radioactivity than basalt, those being the two major rock types in the crust of the Earth. Well, there is a very important question in Earth geology, and that is, what is the origin?